Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Once a month, Mayor Vi Lyles is on the program. Today, we're just 12 days before the start of the Republican National Convention in Charlotte. It will be very different from what was originally envisioned. Most details remain pretty sketchy at the moment. Probably the only people who care about this now is how the only thing that people care about is how the city will keep everybody safe, delegates and us. So we'll ask about that. We'll ask about the Hawthorne Lane Bridge and some city council drama and COVID-19 and more. And Mayor Vi Lyles, welcome back to the program. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Mike, and good morning to all of the listeners out there. Hope everybody's well and staying safe and healthy.
And we're also on Facebook Live this morning, so you can see the mayor in her very nice stage setting this morning. So you're a Democrat. Let me start with your reaction to California Senator Kamala Harris being named as former Vice President Biden's running mate.
I think every one of the women considered would be great choices. And I think that the vice president made the choice for Senator Harris because of her warmth and personality, her really strong skills in what she does in leadership and around working with the Senate, because we need some help to repair those relationships. And I also think that she was chosen just because qualifications matter. For me personally, people often say to me, you're the first Black woman mayor of Charlotte. But for her, she is really multiracial, multicultural. She went to an HBCU, Howard University. Bisons are very proud. But more importantly, I think Kamala is exceptionally qualified to be our next vice president. Hmm.
One pundit yesterday, and I was flipping around watching various coverage of this, one pundit said that this choice crystallizes the stark choice that voters have in November between Trump and Pence, if it is still Pence, because there's some rumors now that he may be jettisoned because of the choice of Kamala Harris, and the choice between Trump-Pence and Biden-Harris. Do you see this as a stark choice? And if so, how would you describe the difference between the two?
I think Harris just added more weight to the Democratic ticket, to tell you the truth. She brings, not just the belief of who she is and her values, but she brings Democratic values first. I have not heard the rumor that Pence would not be the vice president choice for the Republicans. I think it would be pretty difficult to change that right now. That would look like you really were reacting. And I'm not sure that that's always a good political strategy. But what I would say, the strength of the Democratic ticket illustrates the change that we want to see. I often talk about this when young girls come to see me in the office. I tell them, you too can be mayor. Just think, you too can be a vice president. When you see, especially the Black and brown girls that don't have the role models in this political world that we need to have, I'm very excited about the top of the ticket for the Democrats.
So we're just a week away, less than a week away from the Democratic convention, just a couple, 12, I think what I say, 12 days away from the Republican convention here in Charlotte. Normally, we would be all consumed about conversation about these two conventions because it's a political year and a political season. But the reality is we've got so many other things going on, particularly coronavirus, which is going to impact both of these conventions. It's thrown people out of work. It's hurt the economy. It's reduced tax revenues for municipalities. The federal government is spending like there's no tomorrow. Some businesses have closed for good. Others are hanging on by a thread. How would you assess the state of things in Charlotte?
Well, right now, the most important numbers that we have to look at are the positivity scores. And we, a few weeks ago, we were at 10. And 10, I was actually on a call with Dr. Burtz and a number of people on that task force. And we were at over 10% positivity rating. Now, I don't know the background of how they calculate that, but she said on the call, she said, we're looking at Charlotte. This is a 10 means that you've got community spread. Today, because of some of the changes that we've incorporated from the public health director around how we manage our places where people gather in groups, we're down to a six, a little bit over six. So we have to understand that it does mean that we're in a lot of pain and hurt around people being unemployed, people's businesses being stopped. But in the long term, we have to do something about this virus, and we need to get to a level that we can feel comfortable until the vaccine is presented to us. And I know that the president and the federal government have really put a lot of money behind a vaccine. I hope that by 2021, we'll be talking about something differently. We'll be talking about how to get your vaccination and how to manage this. But right now, I know there's been a lot of controversy about shutting off liquor sales and even more strict requirements in our city that we don't serve food at the bar. That's because we had to change this community spread number. And it's hurting a lot of people, and I understand that.
If those things are working, and apparently they are from what you just said, one of the things that we are told consistently by health experts is that wearing masks is the single best thing that we can do at the moment until there is a vaccine, that and social distancing. And now they're saying 6 feet apart may not be enough. Maybe 16 is more like it, but wearing a mask helps. So we have this mask mandate now from the governor. We had it, I think, from local officials, but it was not enforced. It still isn't enforced. Do you think that's responsible for elected officials not to enforce what is apparently a life-saving measure?
There are a lot of cases where we make ordinances or laws or ask people to do things that it really requires the community to respect that ask versus enforcement. We are doing enforcement around the alcohol sales and the bar sitting at the bar together. We had to do that because that was what was taking us up over the 10. I think responsible communities, and Charlotte is one, whenever we ask for engagement and things, we've got so many engagement activities going on from our new safety plan, from our UDO, our general development plan. We hope to set examples for people, and we hope that people will carefully nudge others to participate.
But we have all these people unemployed. We have people running out of the unemployment money that was given to them, the $600 a month that was given to them by the federal government. We have businesses hanging on by a thread. Many of them have gone out of business. We're doing a whole program tomorrow on the restaurant and bar scene in Charlotte, which we had built up to a fairly healthy industry before the COVID-19 panic. If we know... The president has been sometimes, some would say justifiably, criticized for his handling of this crisis. Is some of that blame, should some of that blame be shouldered by mayors and by city councils and county commissions and governors for not enforcing something we know works if the goal is to reopen the economy and save these businesses?
I think the goal is to reopen the economy and to have people be well and safe from this virus. Those are often put as things that are mutually exclusive, but they're not. They're very much tied together. You can't open your restaurant and have your staff have been tested positive for COVID because you end up closing it anyway. So don't try to unconnect those two points. Those are really, really important. As a city, what we're trying to do is make it possible for people to survive this time. You know, we've got the grants for $10,000 up to $25,000 for small businesses. This past Monday, the city council set aside $5 million for restaurants and $3 million for hotels, because those are the areas that we see everybody's is in a difficult situation. All of us are. But there are some places where you can actually see the industry declining. And we looked at the hospitality industry, or I look at the hospitality industry. 1 out of 9 people work in it in Charlotte. And the way that we have to think about this is they need more help. And so we have set aside that money in additional ways for people that are unemployed to get training. We got a new program at the Urban League around HVAC repairs and those kinds of things that we're doing as a city. And these are all pretty much no cost. They are no cost and you get paid because we know that you have to pay your bills in order to get training. So we're helping people that way. And I believe that the hospitality industry is so essential to our recovery because it depends on our tourism. In 2008, Mike, you remember, there was nobody at the convention center. And pretty much that's the way it is. Aside from the committee meeting of the RNC at the convention center, we're not filling any hotels, and we're certainly not helping our restaurants. Right. So the city has stepped in with the CARES money and set aside money to begin working with the hospitality industry. Really important effort here.
In the first round of those relief efforts that came both from state, local, and federal officials, some businesses and some individuals had a great deal of difficulty getting some of that money. Some of them never did, even though they were probably eligible for it. How will people get this money that you just voted on Monday night, and who is eligible for it, and how much money are we talking about per person or per business?
Well, we've set aside over $70 million of our CARES fund to serve the community need. So it's we've tried to make sure people got their mortgages paid, especially people that have just gotten into home ownership, moving up out of rental, that are under 80% of the average median income. We are actually over in the courtroom with mediators to help people pay their rent, the back rent that they may owe, so that they're not evicted. In our business area, we've allocated $15 million for small businesses, and we have made it very simple. There are perhaps 9 things on that list, and you only have to have 3, and they're not that difficult if you're a small business to do. So far, we've spent about $9 million of that 15. We are encouraging people to go to the Foundation for the Carolinas website, make the application, and get the money out so that you can maintain your status until we can reopen after the virus or the vaccine is beginning to be mitigated. The money for the restaurants and hotels will be similarly simple. We are trying to maintain the people that support our tourism industry, and we're not going to make it hard for anybody. This is money that the federal government sent to our city to help people. And you asked about, well, do mayors and governors have to share part of this burden? You can tell in the states that have higher death and higher positive ratings for COVID, where they did not take the money and invest it in the right places. I stand solidly that we are doing everything possible to maintain an equality between two goals that are very difficult to achieve at the same time.
This crisis is leading to lots of cancellations, as we've alluded to. Schools have either canceled or are considering canceling sports events. Some universities have canceled their football seasons this year or put them off till next semester. That's billions of dollars lost. The Charlotte Knights didn't have a season. The Hornets season was truncated. Yesterday, it was announced that the annual Greek festival has been canceled. Haven't heard yet about the festival in the park. These all have economic consequences. Do you have any idea, does anybody in the city have any idea what the economic consequences of all this money lost is?
We are beginning to put that kind of information together. I've asked the city manager to give us a scorecard that we can give to the community so that they can see. I know we all get the numbers, and whenever the national news comes on, I look to see whether we're pointed in red or not as North Carolina. But we need to have something like that that we can talk about. And so we're working on an economic impact statement and talking about the programs and where we've been able to put these programs to measure their effectiveness. You know, the best thing about something like this is it really requires all of us to think what would happen if this kind of thing happened again. And that's what we're trying to do.
Mayor Vi Lyle's with us. We're going to come back and talk more about a lot of different things, including the Hawthorne Street Bridge delay. Oh, boy. Stay with us. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHEI. Mike Collins, Mayor Vi Lyles is with us from someplace deep in the bowels of the Government Center as she joins us every month on this program. Don't forget to unmute yourself, Mayor Lyle, so that we can talk. Residents of Elizabeth must be pulling their hair out, what little they must have left after all these delays on the Hawthorne Street Bridge. That bridge has been closed since 2017, so they can put a streetcar across it. And first, the contractor ordered the wrong girders. They had to stop construction on it. Now something else has gone wrong so that it will not be open for cars as it was scheduled to be anytime soon, but it will hopefully open for pedestrians and for bicyclists by the end of August. So, Mayor, what's wrong this time?
Well, I'm going to tell you my favorite quote. I was watching the news and seeing what people were saying, and one of the people said that, you know, he just needed to reach for his fifth gear of patience. I think he must be a cyclist. And I thought we have asked those folks over in that area to be patient so many times that I don't blame them one bit. This is an awful situation. But I tell you this, I'd rather have the regulations and the inspections and the quality construction that's required of a bridge than not. So yes, it's been a horrible construction project, but at the same time, when we finish it, it'll be done. And we're really glad to see it. I'm glad you mentioned that people will be able to walk over the bridge, will be able to bike over the bridge in August. I think what you're seeing is a situation where sometimes government can have regulations that don't always help us. We're required to take low bid contracts. And in this case, the contractor presented themselves as the best option. And as we couldn't disqualify
them. As the cheapest option.
That's it, the lowest bid option. And mm-hmm. we are required to take the lowest bid.
Let's underline that. The city uses a competitive bidding process, and state law requires the city to award the contract to, quote, the lowest possible responsible bidder. Well, they came through on lowest. Have they come through on responsible?
Well, you know, I can't speak. I'm not a civil engineer, and I'm not running that project. But for the people in that community, I would expect that they would not have good words to say about the contractor.
So Channel 9 reports that this time it's the concrete that does not match design requirements, according to an inspection report. I'm assuming that the inspection report came from a city or a county or a state, whoever's in charge of inspecting infrastructure like that. It came from them. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So would it be correct in saying that the contractor was either unaware that there were quality problems with the concrete or deliberately was going to put subpar concrete in there because that's the only way to meet their low bid cost requirements?
I can't speak to what the contractor thought or what they had done. What I can speak to is that we inspected it. It wasn't up to the standards that they mm-hmm. had to have. We are talking and working on this project every day. I'm sure that the inspectors on the city team are pulling their hair out, but we're not going to finish a bridge that's not correctly designed and executed.
Well, in a June 23rd federal budget meeting, CATS director said that the contractor, Johnson Brothers, is, and this is a quote, ineffective in project management, rail installation, and bridge construction, resulting in poor budgeting, scheduling, construction, and or quality. Is the only requirement for selecting a contractor for this or any project the lowest bid? Does anybody vet these companies? Does anybody ask about quality control and staying on schedule or get references from cities they've worked with before? Or is this just, oh, that's the lowest price, we'll take it?
No, I think that, Mike, you would know, we've got really great people that work here and they do the background checks, they do that. But when things happen like this, you cannot, you can't discover everything about someone. You know, I would say to you that when we made that statement is probably true today. But at this point, we, as a community and as a city, we are going to try to get this bridge done. And I really can't speak to every part of it because we know that there are concrete issues. We knew that there were girder issues. All of these things continue. So I don't believe that the contractor will be getting a good reference from the city.
Has the city used Johnson Brothers in the past, or is this a first flirtation?
I don't know the answer to that question. I would expect that at some point they presented themselves as an excellent way at the lowest cost to do this bridge, and that has not been proven to be true.
When you consider this mishap, the girders, the concrete, and possibly other things that we haven't talked about or don't know about, and the fact that the city ended up millions of dollars short in completing the Greenway just a year and a half or two ago, it was discovered that something was wrong with that. Is something fundamentally wrong with how we're doing things in this city, big projects like this? In fact, Kirby emailed, is it me or is it difficult for the city to make big projects happen?
Well, we've done big projects. I think you have to look at the Blue Line extension. You have to look at some of our major highway chain construction projects. So we have done big projects. We've done the convention center. We've done many big projects. But when you have a doozy, you really have a doozy.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like we've got kind of like the uncle that came to the holidays with too much, too many things to say and not enough to do.
This is not a reflection on you, because this is not what you do as the city's mayor. This is what city management does and the city departments do. Do we have a problem there?
Again, I think one of the good things about Charlotte, and this is one of the reasons that during this pandemic, we are actually able to push $70 million of federal funding out to the community, is that we have people that are well qualified to do their jobs and to get the work done. So when I start thinking about how do we do our construction, we will go back and look at it. We always try to figure out what's going on when something goes wrong. And that retrospective look takes place every time. If there are changes to be made, we'll find them and we'll make them. We are known for getting into the details and getting them repaired and fixed for the next time. When we have problems, we acknowledge them, it's what we're doing right now. But at the same time, we put a team of people together from across all of our organization to come in and say, all right, this happened. What will be done differently in the future?
This bridge is going to carry new streetcars, not the one that we've come to see on the streets of Charlotte, but new, heavier, longer streetcars. It's going to carry automobile traffic and trucks. It's going to carry bicyclists and pedestrians, and it's going to cross Independence Boulevard. I think it's about 10 lanes there. That's a long span of a bridge. Given the fact that we knew about the snafu with the girders, and we know now about the snafu with the concrete, what about things we may not know about? Do you have confidence that this bridge has structural integrity? How do we know it's going to be safe?
That's why we're not giving up on inspections all the time. That's how we found out what we know today. We would not know these problems if we just took a blind eye. We have people on that site every day looking at every aspect of it. And so what we're trying to do is understand why this contractor has done this. You know, the contractor has done public work before. They've worked in our Charlotte Water projects. We've worked in some projects with them on stormwater. Just perhaps this one is kind of like the bad apple in our fruit bowl. So I just think that while we will continue to monitor, that bridge will not be open without passing every appropriate standard, every safety regulation we have, and we're inspecting it every day, every night to make sure that that happens. The issues around construction like this is that we, to go back and redo, what we're trying to do is repair.
Okay. Let's go back a little bit to some more COVID-19 related stuff. We know that restaurants have had a tough time of this during the pandemic, but now 18 businesses have registered to use their parking spaces and extra street space for outdoor dining. Is this something that they've already received council approval for?
Absolutely, yes. We want to help our restaurants meet that percentage of occupancy that they can have under the governor's rules. And so we are taking parking spaces and we're taking lanes of street. And if there is a restaurant that feels like that this is something they do, yes, we want to support them and help them do it. And we are making sure, in fact, we talked about this on Monday night. We don't see this as a transition. Many people have commented to us you know, in summer in Charlotte with humidity, that's usually when we have our worst air quality. Some of this pandemic will cause us to make changes that perhaps there won't be as many cars on the street, but that street right of way that could be effectively utilized by a restaurant. And that's something I think we will see permanent changes as a result of this.
Was this the idea of the restaurant industry, or was this the idea floated by somebody on city council to allow this to happen?
Last night I was taking a survey, a national survey for mayors across the country. And one of the questions was whether or not the changes that we're making as a result of the pandemic would be pullback, temporary or permanent. In this case, we're going to take some things and make them permanent. And the use of right-of-way for hospitality, the use of outdoor space will be better. And we're going to make those efforts by our hospitality industry for recovery to be permanent. I think that most of us think, well, one day we'll all get a vaccine and the next day everything will be well. But for people to really change and adjust to the requirements that a pandemic has pushed on us as a country, some of the hotels probably won't come back until 2024, no matter what the vaccine is. Some of our restaurants won't be able to come back as quickly as others. So what can we do to get out of their way? That's our whole goal, to get out of their way so that we can have the recovery that's sustainable long term.
So what do restaurants who would like to participate in this have to do? Are there hoops to jump through? Are there requirements, outlines, structures?
You're asking me a really hard question. I would say to you that if there is a hoop, we're going to take the hoop to the restaurant and help them jump through.
One of the things that this pandemic is doing is putting people at risk of losing their homes, being evicted, because that's a major problem. And we've talked in the past about affordable housing, and that's one of your pet projects that you've been very successful with in trying to increase the stock of affordable housing that we have here. But we also know that evictions lead to housing instability, and that's a major problem, too, with upward mobility. How will this pandemic and the rising rates of evictions impact the ability for people to find affordable housing?
Well, the first thing we want to do is keep them in affordable housing. I tell you, I want to thank the clerk of court, Elise Shin Gary, because when there is an order or a request by a real estate owner to evict someone, when they actually have to serve those papers, we send it with information on how you can have, how you can get help. First of all, we've set up a mediation between tenants, particularly those with under 80% of median income. We have a dispute settlement program that's been working for a long time. We've expanded that to settle the dispute between the landlord and the tenant on back rent. We have that $8 million that we put out there that we can write that landlord a check so that they can have the money that they need to pay their own bills, but we can keep someone in their housing. With that landlord dispute settlement doesn't, mediation doesn't work out, then we go to the courthouse and we, the county, thank you to the Mecklenburg County Commissioners, they have paid some, what I call legal aid, I can't remember the new name, but they come down with a lawyer. Most of our evictions that occurred pre-COVID were people didn't have representation. Now we have lawyers representing them, again, trying to work out a settlement agreement using the funding that we've got from the federal government to pay for people's rent. Same situation on mortgage payments. We're working with their financial institution to get their mortgages paid. So far, we've put $8 million towards that program, and I think we've spent about $4 million of it.
Greg on Facebook asks, can we talk about homelessness and the tent communities? What is the plan for people getting evicted from apartments? You've talked a little bit about this now.
All of us. It's probably one of the most difficult cases that we have to deal with. Let me just tell you what we've done so far for people that are homeless. One, the city has funded in with the faith community and as well as the private sector and philanthropic sector, the redo of both the roof above shelters, one on Statesville and one on Tryon Street. We've also contributed to the development of a new single room occupancy, much like Moore's Place, that we have put $2 million in for that. So then we get to the most difficult part, which is if we can't shelter people and we can't provide them a permanent place to live, how do we deal with the folks in tents? And this is what I would say. We have to do it working together. We need our the advocates that are going out and talking about this. We all want to do something, but the populations in the tents are some of the most difficult cases to deal with. And we have done the traditional, as you talked about. I really love that we work so well on affordable housing, that we're trying to build more and we're trying to make more shelters available. Mm-hmm. Right now, we have three hotels that we are housing the homeless in. Two of them are for, one of them is for people that have tested positive for COVID. And then the other two are just people that are homeless as a result of not being able to get into a shelter. And yet still in the city, we have people in tents. So I expect us to make more utilization of homeless for homeless shelters in hotels. I also expect that the folks in our tent need the most amount of services. We need to especially have services in mental health and substance abuse. And that means we have to do something that's really significant. And we're having conversations now with the advocates for our homeless population, the county and the city. We can't ignore what's going on down there. And my heart wrenches for that.
I have a minute left, Mayor. Greg on Facebook, Greg Jackson from Heal Charlotte, says, I have five families that call me almost every day saying they're being evicted. They did not receive any help. I had to connect them with legal aid myself. So what's the workaround for that? I have less than a minute left.
I think that one of the things that we can do is they should call 311 and ask for community relations. And Greg, I will follow up with Greg on those five families as well this week. But if you're just really afraid that you're going to be evicted and you don't know what to do, call 311 and ask for community relations.
Mayor Vial Lyles with us for the remainder of the hour. We're going to be talking about some other things on City Council, the fact that Charlotte grew a little bit this week. I bet you nobody knows that. We grew by, I think, 137 acres. And we'll talk about the Republican National Convention, which is coming here in 12 days. How are we going to keep everybody safe? We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Mayor Vial Lyles, as we do on a regular basis here on this program, about a lot of different things. COVID-19 has thrown a wrench into a lot of different things, and one of the things it's thrown a wrench into is something that is vitally important to North Carolina and to Americans everywhere, and that is the census. The census started online a couple of months ago, but a lot of people haven't responded online, and so they've been sending people out, but then there's COVID-19, and people don't like to knock on doors or answer their doors, and that's going to leave a lot of people out. And on top of that, the president has decided to shorten the period of time that the census will be taken. What's at stake here, Mayor Lyles?
Well, you know, at stake are millions of dollars, because much of the federal funding that we get is based on population or the types of populations that we have to need to serve. And so this would really harm us if people don't send in those forms, because or call or fill them out online, whatever you have to do, because the money that we get for community development services, the services that we're talking about most needed during COVID, like housing, lead paint abatement, all of those kinds of services are based on population. And then there's the political side of it. If we have a population that grows more, then there's a reapportionment of the House of Representatives. And if our population grows in North Carolina, particularly on the 85 corridor, then we may get another congressional seat. The more representatives we have, the better off we are in having conversations with the federal government.
Also, it's involved in the drawing of congressional districts and, I believe, legislative districts. And so this is another instance where, if elections have consequences, the census also has consequences. So how would you tell somebody, if they haven't filled out the census form yet, what would you tell them to do?
I'd say that the president has set a deadline of September the 30th, that you must go to my2020census.gov, wherever you can find a computer, go to my2020census.gov. You can also call and they will have you can have options of different languages. And then census workers will be knocking on doors until the end of September. But I think the easiest way is online, but you can also call 844-330-2020, 844-330-2020. Please go out and fill out that form. Billions of dollars are at stake, as well as our political strength in North Carolina.
And unless you get the long form, which very few people do, I think it took me less than 5 minutes to fill the thing out. I'm not even sure it took 2 minutes to fill it. Two city council members, Democrat Dimple Ajmera and James Mitchell, expressed concerns a couple of weeks ago, Madam Mayor, that there would be the appearance of impropriety had fellow city councilman Republican Tariq Bukhari's organization, Carolina FinTech Hub, administered a training program that was to be funded by the city. Bukhari has denied any wrongdoing, but now the North Carolina Republican Party has filed complaints against Ajmera and Mitchell for launching what they described as personal attacks against Bukhari. The NCGOP says they, quote, decided to shine a light on the real ethics violations that have been occurring in Charlotte for years. Before we talk about those allegations, is this unprecedented?
Well, we've had other ethics violations in our city. As you know, we've had a mayor that had to leave office. We've also had one other council member in my recall that has been charged with an ethics violation. But Mike, in this situation, what I think is going on is I see it just across every footprint for me. What I see is that since we've had COVID going on since March, it's a long 4 or 5 months. And for the council, it's been particularly difficult because, you know, we call each other colleagues because we're often close with each other. We have a lot of conversations. But if you have to do everything with something by just never having that physical experience, the ability to look at someone in the eye, the ability to have a conversation that goes beyond what you're trying to do every Monday night, I think you're seeing the impact not just on our colleagues on the council, but I've noticed a real change in my email tones. People are more demanding or they're more negative around things. And a lot of this has come, I believe, from not having the ability to just sit down and iron things out.
So going back a couple of weeks, I don't believe that Dimple Ajmera or James Mitchell were accusing Tariq of doing anything wrong, but they were concerned that giving money to a program that he operates wouldn't pass the smell test, essentially. I think somebody actually said that. So the result is that the Carolina FinTech Hub is not participating in this. So what is the state GOP alleging, and how do you think this will play out?
Well, my recall is that the city attorney said that he did not find any violations of our ethics with the consideration that we were giving to Carolina FinTech, which is an organization founded by Councilmember Bukhari. And based upon that, we would still be required under our rules to have an investigation if someone files a complaint. And that's for anything. You could pick up the phone or call the clerk right now, fill out a form and investigate any one of us. And so we're gonna look at our ethics policy to make sure it's standard across the country and especially for good government. You know, I majored in this stuff. And one of the things that I believe is that in government, you cannot have the slightest hint of any kind of corruption. So the council made a decision, and Mr. Bukhari, that they would not consider this, even if it just gave the appearance. And so that was the vote that was taken, and that's the way that I think we ended on the Carolina FinTech.
But the state GOP is alleging that there have been violations, ethical violations, going on for years. Do you think that's just politics, or is there some substance to those accusations?
I can't say that I've been in this organization now as an elected official for 6 years now. or more, almost seven. And I worked in this organization for a number of years. And I can tell you that when people come to us and they say, well, I want to go see the mayor because they think that the mayor can do something to help them, a developer, by just taking someone out to dinner or whatever. And what they don't realize in Charlotte is that we have ethical standards for our staff and the city manager, as well as council. And so when you have that, it's not in other communities, it may be okay to come see the mayor and suggest all kinds of things, but in this community, no, that's just not acceptable. And so all of our developers, usually most of our contractors know that. So I stand by, we've elected good people, and maybe sometimes we don't get it exactly right, but I believe everyone is well-intentioned and trying to be representative of of all of our residents, all of our constituents, and do the very best job that they can.
So Charlotte has grown substantially over the years because primarily through annexation, not just population influx, but annexation. And this week, we annexed 137 acres to accommodate 682 new houses and apartments. Where was this land? Because I would think there's not that much unincorporated area left to annex.
You'd be surprised. There's a lot of unincorporated area, particularly around our Highway 485 and beyond. There is still room for us to grow. The thing about it is that we can't grow just because someone built. And, you know, they changed the annexation law. I like to say what Richard Bender used to say, if it's urban, it's Charlotte. In this case, what we have to do is persuade people by the services that we provide that it is a better deal for the people that buy their homes in these developments. So they're on the outer ring of, they were in District 4 out by the university area, and I believe some of them were in the southern part of the city. But what I would say to you most importantly is that when you are annexed, you get the city services of water and policing. And all of that seems to be, I think, important considerations when someone buys a home.
So the Republican National Convention is 12 days away. Despite being scaled down tremendously, it is still considered to be a high-risk event. The plans for that convention, at least as far as the public is concerned, have been pretty sketchy. We have no real clue about what's going to go on. We know it's going to be about 500 as opposed to 50,000 people coming in. Are you and the council aware of what they intend to do and how they intend to do it?
Well, I think they're going to have a committee meeting. I don't think that they're saying 500 anymore. We've been talking about 350 people. Okay. They're going to have a committee meeting. They're going to nominate the president. And wherever the president accepts the nomination, I don't think that has been determined. But in terms of, we are beginning to roll out the traffic plan and the security area, but it's not going to be 2012 where we were celebrating and very joyous atmosphere and the whole downtown was kind of like a big area to celebrity watch. This is going to be primarily around the convention center area and the hotels that they're going to be utilizing. And I think they've chosen one hotel instead of a number of them. But we're trying really to make sure our restaurants in the area know that people will be available, that we'll follow all the social distancing guidelines, wear your mask, and they have committed to that. They have hired an epidemiologist who is with Homeland Security, who has left Homeland Security and now does this kind of work. I think that while we're going to have this convention from Friday to Monday, we will be sure that safety is our number one priority, both from a security as well as a health.
How are we going to do that? I know that there are protocols that this Dr. Jeff, is it Rung or Rungi, who used to be with Homeland Security. He's the senior medical advisor now to this convention. And he has all these protocols in place. But a lot of the president's most ardent supporters believe that wearing a mask is stupid, a waste of time, ineffective, and an infringement on their constitutional rights. So if a delegate chooses not to wear a mask, is that going to be enforced?
I think, Mike, that while I believe that there are a lot of people that in the president's camp, they don't believe in masks, but we're talking about a committee that is coming here for a meeting with prescribed protocols. They're going to be enforcing those. Those protocols include something that I was not even aware of, but it has kind of a GPS chip. so that badges. There can be contact tracing. They're doing temperature checks. They're doing daily COVID testing checks, symptoms checks. And remember, the people that chose to come to this meeting are people that are part of the party structure, the Republican Party structure. So this isn't just a rally. These are people with a job to do. They're coming to Charlotte to do this work. And I believe that they will follow the protocols. If not, I think that they have... they will deal with those consequences, because if anything happens, it's about them. They don't want to leave something in our city that's not just positive. They are not going to go for the negative side of this.
So you're convinced that our the people in Charlotte who come into contact with these folks from all over the country, where there are varying degrees of COVID infection, they will be safe. The restaurant employees, the hotel employees, et cetera. I'm sorry.
I think if you look at the protocols that have been set up by Dr. Runji, that they are being tested before they come and they're being tested when they arrive. And so that means that we're going to really follow through, I believe, every day, and the kinds of things that they're doing. And they're also doing this for the hospitality industry, people that work with them. So they will have the same protocols for anyone that's involved in this convention and the committee activities.
2020 has been a year plagued by this virus, and also for calls for social justice around the country that continue in the aftermath of the death of George Floyd. We've seen how the pandemic has impacted those at the lower end of the economic scale, and we are also seeing that that's where social justice efforts probably need to be concentrated as well. You have outlined several steps recently on how to help balance these scales. And on Monday night, you read an apology during the meeting, the city council meeting. The apology was a result, I'm told, by work by Advocates for Restorative Justice, CLT. And you apologized on behalf of city leaders for decades of inequality, pointing out the Jim Crow era, redlining, upper mobility, Charlotte's urban renewal policies of the 60s when Brooklyn Village in the Second Ward was razed and displaced more than 1,000 families. Talk about that.
Well, Mike, you know, I am a Black woman in the South, grew up in the South, and I tell the story when Johnson C. Smith, which is our HBCU, and Myers Park, where I went to Queens, and you see the houses surrounding them. The houses that are that old were the same type of houses being built at the same time when the city did not have the resulting federal legislation that redlined communities. So the house in Myers Park is restored. Everybody still loves them. The house that the professor and the president of the university lived in, they couldn't go get a loan to maintain their houses, so they had to do what they had to do. They often became boarding houses. And then they often became houses of rooming versus boarding. And so you're seeing some of these really beautiful homes on the West Side that didn't survive because of federal legislation. There are so many instances where the system was rigged against African Americans that we can all use as examples. And that's what this apology was for, the government's participation in that. But also in that policy, I said that our council today is the most progressive one around social justice ever. And that's a change that needed to occur.
And you did outline several ways to balance the economic playing field here, reducing trauma with our violence interruption programs, funding Black business in opportunity corridors, committing to creating opportunities for jobs and working wages, meaning livable wages, developing partnerships with businesses, and measuring the results of change with transparency. I wish we had time to talk about them, but we're out of time. So maybe we'll talk about that in a future conversation.
The next month, Mike.
Okay. Mayor Vi Lyles, thanks for the hour.
Thank you for having me.